The history of Rocky Horror is a history of cinema.
For everything you like about Rocky Horror, there was at least one film that inspired it.
And we're going to review them all on Episode Zero.
And welcome back to Episode Zero, the Rocky Horror Picture Show podcast, where we don't really talk about the Rocky Horror Picture Show. My name is William Bibbiani. I'm a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I, too, am a critic. I don't have a cute nickname. And why did you say it so scoldingly?
I don't know. I just tried to mix
it
up.
We don't talk about the Rocky Horror Picture Show here.
Again, you say the same thing over and over again. After a while, you start just, like, try to have fun with it, and every once in a while you just say it in such a weird way, everyone's like, the hell is wrong with you? And I'm like, I don't know. I've done like dozens of these and hundreds of the other ones, and I like to have fun. I'm a cool guy.
What are we talking about this week, William?
Okay, well, every week on Episode Zero, we talk about the prehistory of a pop culture phenomenon. Stuff like Star Wars didn't come from out of nowhere. There was a ton of media that presaged it and directly influenced it. And that's totally true for the Rocky Horror Picture Show, the midnight movie phenomenon that is still going strong. And yeah, it is directly influenced by a lot of movies, mostly sci-fi horror, but others as well. And today, we're talking about one of the many songs that were name-checked in the opening number from Rocky Horror, a science fiction double feature, includes references to a ton of old-school, mostly B-movie sci-fi and horror flicks.
Yeah.
And today, we're going to talk about one that I had actually never seen. I think I thought I had, because it's got one of those generic titles. Like, you know,
well, it's referenced. The title itself is referenced so much.
Yeah.
And it came out in a very specific era in American science fiction history.
Where there were a lot of stuff that sounded like it.
Yeah.
Like, well, it conquered the world. It conquered the world. Terror from beyond space.
Well, just it came from outer space. Invasion of the Saucer Men. The things that were unique at the time, but came
Zeitgeisty.
came to represent the most generic elements of the genre.
At least
over
in the 1950s.
In the years that that came after it.
And so, yeah,
we'll talk about that in a little bit.
Well, let's talk about, let's get right to it then. Let's talk about, It Came from Outer Space?
Yes, it came from outer space to fill the world with terror, to bring you unforgettable suspense. What was it? Where did it come from? Who were the all-powerful creatures it brought from outer space? And what did they want on Earth? You can learn the amazing answer only when you see the most thrilling picture in years. It Came from Outer Space. In the astonishing realism of three dimension, with objects coming right out of the screen, so real they almost touch you.
There's no question mark in the title.
I love it in trailers. We were just having a conversation about this before the podcast. Yeah. I love it in trailers where they say something like, yes! It came from outer space, as though we were incredulous at the title. Like, what? Surely not. No. One of my favorite openings, and I actually haven't seen the movie in a while, so I hope I'm remembering this correctly, is from the movie I Walked with a Zombie. And if memory serves, the opening line of dialogue is, yes, I walked with a zombie. And I'm like, oh, I guess that wraps that up. Confirmed.
Well, it's not called Who Walked with a Zombie. Well, I walked with a zombie. We want to hear that story. If it's who walked with a zombie, and the first line was, I did.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, well, I'm going home now.
Yeah.
I know the answer to that question.
It would be like, who framed Roger Rabbit? And it was like, that guy. I'm like, oh, cool.
It was Judge Doom. He framed Roger Rabbit.
Yeah. Spoilers, but yeah. He's the only bad guy in the movie.
Yeah.
Who else could it be? It's a kid's movie. It's fun.
It's not a mystery.
It's not a great mystery, but it's fun. Anyway, It Came from Outer Space. Is a sci-fi film, damn it.
Came out in 1953 from director Jack Arnold, who also did Creature from the Black Lagoon and The Incredible Shrinking Man. So this guy is responsible for three very notable science fiction classics.
Yeah, Creature from the Black Lagoon is typically considered like the last great Universal monster movie, even though the majority of the Universal monsters came out between like 1931 and 1941. At least that's when they were introduced. Creature was like the 50s. And he's just such a cool monster. Everyone grandfathered him in. It's like, oh yeah, he's one of the originals, right?
Yeah, you'll watch it back to back with Dracula came out in 31.
Yeah.
And Creature from the Black Lagoon didn't come out till 54. So yeah, there was this big gap.
By
the time Creature from the Black Lagoon had come out, in fact, science fiction had changed a lot. Monster movies had changed a lot.
Yeah.
So it's kind of unusual that the Creature from the Black Lagoon is considered on par with a character like Dracula. Dracula comes from literature. And there's something very operatic about Dracula. I know he wears capes and lives in haunted castles.
A lot of over-the-top melodrama in Dracula.
Full moons and lightning. And Creature from the Black Lagoon is about...
Fishman.
It's about a fishman who lives in this unexplored place. And it's about how people are sort of encroaching a little too far. That is to say, colonialists are encroaching a little bit
too
far.
Or if you want to look at it from an environmentalist perspective, we are messing with the Amazon, that kind of thing.
Wrecking too much of the jungle.
Yeah, Creature from the Black Lagoon is a very modern... type monster, and the other Universal horror monsters were very classical. The emphasis was more on their character, whereas the creature, other than he's the only one of his kind, and as a result, when he sees a woman, it's like the closest thing he can recognize, so that explains his interest. But other than that, he doesn't have a personality.
Yeah,
he's a fish, and I really like that movie a lot. But for me, the absolute classic that Jack Arnold did was The Incredible Shrinking Man from 1957, which is, as far as I'm concerned, upper echelon top 20 sci-fi films ever made.
Oh, for
sure. Maybe even the top 10. I haven't done my research. I haven't, like, listed them all out yet. But, like, it's a great, pulpy, simple concept. Guy is exposed to radioactive stuff. Guy starts to shrink. And you've got all the great shrinking visual effects you could possibly want from that. You got him fighting a spider with, like, a nail. And, like, all that stuff is awesome. But it's also, by the end, genuinely profound.
Yeah. And it actually gets, like, super philosophical. Not even at the end. Like, he actually starts to contemplate these things.
No, like, they earn it. Like, that's how they don't just tack it on. Yeah.
And indeed, that kind of philosophical poetry, if you will, it used to be kind of hand in glove with science fiction if you're familiar with a lot of, like, pulp stories and weird tales that were being published in the decades previous.
Yeah.
A lot of really ambitious science fiction writers were putting out these novels. They sold for very cheap, and a lot of them were quite bad.
Yeah.
But, you know, occasionally you'd have, like, this is where people like H.P. Lovecraft became popular. Like, his stories started to leak into these pulp novels. And, this idea that you can look out at the world and start to speculate about the future, speculate about life on other planets, and instantly get really philosophical used to be kind of the baseline reading for a lot of science
fiction. Idea is that as we approach and encounter the unknown, we're not just supposed to shoot it.
Yeah.
We're supposed to actually think about it and go, wow, our place in the universe is not what we thought it was. And that's incredible.
And indeed, It Came from Outer Space features a lot of dialogue where people are just sort of standing. They shot out at Joshua Tree. It's a cheap-ass movie.
Yeah.
We don't see the alien.
The visual effects are actually pretty expensive. It wasn't cheap-ass, but they didn't spend money on the
location. It has the same kind of bland locations you'd see in an Ed Wood movie. And they go out, and there's people just sort of standing on the edge of the desert looking out and saying, so many ways the desert could kill you. It's like, oh, it's a dead place. There's a lot of life out there, and And so many opportunities for, like, and there, you know, what is happening out in the desert? Are we alone? Like, all these kind of little moments of deep contemplation. And the main character is the most thoughtful character, luckily. They don't, like, sort of go into a cabin and receive some thoughtful sage advice from an old seer and then go and commit the act of action.
Yeah.
The main character is the thoughtful one.
Yeah, the main character is named John Putnam. He's played by Richard Carlson, who also starred in The Creature from the Black Lagoon. He also starred in one of my favorite unsung movies of the era, The Maze. Did you ever see The Maze?
Oh, I never saw The Maze.
The Maze was directed by the incredible William Cameron Menzies, who has practically invented modern production design as we know it. and he was credited for a lot of like the visual effects in Gone with the Wind. He's a really influential figure. And he also directed some really kooky, weird sci-fi films. Mm. He directed the original Invaders from Mars, which actually has a lot of the same DNA as It Came from Outer Space, because it's about aliens crash landing and paranoia and taking over the town. And, oh no, our Americano, what will happen? But I think that one's got a little bit more personality than this, as much as I like this movie. But he also did this really weird Lovecraftian film called The Maze, which stars Richard Carlson as a guy who's just going about his business. Everything's cool. He's about to get married. Everything's going pretty good in his life. And then he inherits a castle from like his old Scottish part of the family. Mm. And he goes to the castle and then he vanishes. And his fiance comes looking for him and says, "Hey, what happened? And why do you look so sick?" And he was like, "You must never come to the castle again." And she's trying to investigate what happened to him that made him retreat, and what is the mystery of the giant hedge maze that surrounds this castle. I will not tell you the big reveal. Suffice it to say that I'm pretty good at guessing twist endings, and I had no fucking idea. It totally, I'm not sure it works, but it sure is different. So it's a neat little spooky movie with some campy elements, and much like It Came from Outer Space, it's also early 3D.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of really interesting 3D effects in this. A lot of them are the kind of stuff we've seen now, you know, helicopter shots over mountains, like, ooh, scale. But there's also some really interesting visual effects components to this movie. And I think whenever the visual, this is one of those rare movies where I'm like, you know, you see a movie sometimes and the movie sucks, but at least the visual effects are good. Here the movie's good, but the visual effects are so novel in some regards. There's this amazing shot where Richard Carlson and Barbara Rush, who plays his girlfriend, they're in the desert and they're investigating these mysterious alien goings on. And the plot's really simple. A giant meteor crash lands into the desert, but it turns out it's actually a giant spaceship. But no one believes our hero, John Putnam, because he's the only person who saw that it was a spaceship before there was a big cave-in. Mm. And so now he's telling everyone, "I think there are aliens here." And they're like, "Nah." But everyone keeps getting kidnapped by aliens. There's this amazing bit where someone's been attacked by the aliens. And we've got this incredible, like, POV shot where it's though we're inside the eye of the alien looking out through the lens. And there's, like, this weird kind of watery distortion as though we're looking through, you know, the
alien's single eyeball.
Yeah, really neat. And then there's a bit of a mist on the side of the screen, and then the mist coalesces into a translucent arm that, like a video game, like you would have, like, coming out of the screen, and it reaches out and it touches Barbara Rush, and he turns around and he screams at you, and I'm like, I had to rewind it. That was gorgeous. That was creepy and ethereal and really magical. Like, I wasn't entirely sure they did it at first.
It's good drama. It's also a good budgetary thing where you can show the reaction to the monster, a strange way of seeing the monster without actually having a monster on screen. Yeah. There's a general bit of wisdom that circulates through genre filmmaking that the less you see the monster, the better, or the more you hold it off.
Yeah.
Thanks to modern CGI, they can show the monster right away and they're just going to do it.
Frequently.
You know, even in like early Godzilla movies, they usually waited like 20 or 30 minutes before a monster would show up.
I think the secret to getting away with this is because you don't want the monster to be up so much that they lose their mystery or their magic or their horror. You don't want to just become familiar with them like, "Oh, hey, it's Jason." Like, that's not great. But what you want to do is you want to hold off. You want to tease. You want to gradually reveal a little bit more over time. And then once we see the dang thing, we want to spend a little time with it.
Yeah.
And I think a movie like Predator gets this really right.
Yeah.
Like the last act, you're just seeing the Predator and the Predator looks cool. Alien does the same thing where they hold off on showing like the full-sized alien for so long. But towards the end, like in that last bit where Ripley is like on the escape pod, you just get a really long look at it. And you're just like, "Yeah, I was right to be scared of that thing. That thing's scary as fuck." Yeah, thank you. Thank you for that. That's great.
Yeah, it's really upsetting when they finally show the monster and it looks silly.
Yeah.
I saw a really low-budget horror film called Hypothermia once.
I don't know this one.
It was about characters who were going ice fishing and a creature was coming up through the ice and dragging him down into the hole. And we didn't get to see it. We just saw like people's like fingernail marks scraping in the snow as they were dragged underneath. And
oh, I remember you telling about this. Yeah.
It wasn't directed, but it was produced by Fassenden. It was one of those, one of Larry Fassenden's sort of projects.
Yeah.
And by the time we saw the monster, like it was like a guy in a head to toe wetsuit. It was all black, and it had these big, ridiculous, like, glued-on shark eyes, and a big, like, flappy shark mouth, and a little fin on top of his head.
Oh, that's not it, good. Like, you're shark, best off not showing that.
Shark Boy from Shark Boy and Lava Girl looked better.
Oh, that's too bad.
Yeah.
The one I think of most is, we just referenced it, It Conquered the World, which is a Roger Corman movie.
Yeah.
Starring Lee Van Cleef and Beverly Garland and, was it Richard Graves? Wait, who was in that?
Peter Graves.
Peter Graves, thank you. And it's about Lee Van Cleef is a scientist who makes contact with aliens on Venus.
Hmm.
And because scientists on Earth do not believe his crackpot theories, he decides to align himself with the aliens from Venus and help them take over the world. It Conquered the World. Not just the title, but a spoiler. We see like little bat creatures like fly around and like attach themselves to people's neck, and that's how they control their minds. And they look a little goofy, but that's not the weirdest thing we've ever seen. So you can kind of forgive it.
Mm.
When you finally see the Venusian, it's the stupidest looking thing.
They're being invaded by a giant Vlasic pickle.
And Vlasic pickle wishes it looked this ridiculous. Like then they could sell it. I don't know what the fuck it looks like. Honestly, it looks like the stalk from a pumpkin. But, like, with like, little beads on it for eyes, but it's giant. Like, I don't know.
It looks like a bomb pop with horns and a little stupid face down near the ground, and then these two weird tentacle arms.
Yeah, it's just awful. Frank Zappa literally wrote a song about it called Cheapness. Okay? It's a really bad monster. So it's a really important... Mm. And it conquered... Sorry, It Came From Outer Space. Pulls the gag... Where they spend most of the time, like, inhabiting people bodies so that they can roam about amongst us.
Mm.
But whenever we actually get a look at it, it looks really cool. Like, it's this, like, really weird, clearly biological organism. It's got, like, stray wisps of hair. Like, they weren't trying to make it look sexy or even frightening. They were just trying to make it look weird. And it turns out, according to the research I've done, they came up with two designs for the creatures. Uh-huh. And It Came From Outer Space. One of which they used for It Came From Outer Space. The other they used for This Island Earth and the Metaluna Mutant.
Oh, it's the Mutant. Okay.
Yeah. And like, those are both two of the great alien designs.
That's true. Although, it was a wise choice. The cool thing about the aliens in It Came From Outer Space is they look really alien.
Yeah.
And in fact, that's the biggest plot point in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
It comes straight from Childhood's End, the Arthur C. Clarke novel as well. The fact that alien creatures look so alien to us that we are unable to get past our prejudices to accept them.
Yeah. When we look up, human beings like to project.
We
like to see our face in things that just have like two dots on a line.
Mm.
When we see animals that have like cute faces that remind us of us, like cats... We think to themselves, oh, they think they're people. They're giving human... They're not. Luca.
They're animals. It's
they're
fine.
They're animals and they have personalities, but they don't operate the way that we do. And, like, the further removed from something that looks kind of like us it is, the less we project humanity onto it.
Mm.
So it's hard to, like, project humanity onto a paramecium.
Yeah.
It's just... It's not the first thing that occurs to us. So if an alien looked completely different from us, the aliens surmise... quite rightly, that a lot of human beings wouldn't be very open-armed.
Yeah, the plot of Childhood's End is some aliens arrive at Earth and they say, we're going to usher you into the next stage of human evolution. You're just going to be a better species. You're going to become a different species.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody says, I don't know about this. Why don't you show yourselves? No, we'll just help you by remote. You hear our voices now. And by the time they land and we get to see them, like years down the line... They look like demons. They're like these red-skinned, bat-winged creatures with horns.
Yeah.
And they say, see?
Yeah.
If we appeared out of the sky and said, hey, look at us, we're going to help you, you would have said, no, you're the devil.
Yeah.
Good. We've read your books.
Mm-hmm.
So this idea that we're too prejudiced to accept alien creatures was kind of a running theme through a lot of science fiction as
well. The cool thing about It Came From Outer Space from a plot perspective, and again, the plot's really simple, is initially it's all about will Richard Carlson's character be able to convince the town that he's right and aliens have landed. He's not specifically fear-mongering. He's not saying they're all going to kill us. He just knows that they're here.
Yeah.
And he wants people to know. There's this amusing bit at the beginning where they're talking about, he and Barbara Rush are talking about their plans of the future and will they be able to get married on his reporter's salary. And he's so happy. He sold one story. And he's like, yeah, I sold one story. It's only enough to finish the outside of the house. And I'm like, what the fuck?
What kind of salaries are you getting?
The majority of the, oh my God. I can barely pay my gas bill with like what most articles pay nowadays. Like, it's ridiculous. So that was just hilarious. But yeah, he's just trying to, he's looking for the truth. He's interested. And everyone else around him just doesn't believe him.
Yeah.
And when they do start to believe him, when things are start happening, people do start disappearing and other people are noticing, that's when the sheriff just goes, well, time to start killing.
Yeah.
And he picks up his gun. He has an interesting speech, which feels very much like a modern speech. Like, this is not the kind of speech you would normally hear in like... It's what I call the did you know speech, where the screenwriter looked up one interesting factoid and built a whole monologue around it. And this is very common today, not so much in the 50s. And it's just like, yeah, I read an article once that said most murders happen at 92 degrees. Lower than 92 degrees, it's just too cold and you can't be bothered. More than 92 degrees, we're just too hot and you can't be bothered. But 92, that's a killing temperature. It's a great line. Yeah. But it reminds us that, like, this movie has an attitude.
Mm.
And the attitude is that the social structures that we have and that the police that we rely on ostensibly for our safety, they're really flawed humans.
Mm.
And
well, we
shouldn't rely on them for things like first contact with an alien species.
And they're often presented, not just in this film, but in other films like it, as being the true representatives of humanity.
Mm-hmm. At its worst, but yeah.
Go even all the way up to something like Arrival, where we are concerned with how we're talking to these alien creatures, because it's actually the military who are representing the bulk of the action that's going to be taken.
Yeah, and we're starting to look at that now even like a smaller level, like, you know, we're looking at police reform right now really seriously in this country, and we should be doing more. But one of the things that we're looking at when we talk about things like defunding the police, what we're not meaning is that there should be no police ever.
Mm.
What we're saying is that maybe we shouldn't be giving all the money to, like, you know,
mental health legislation.
Yeah, exactly. Legislation. Maybe the police shouldn't be involved in helping people with mental health issues.
Mm.
Maybe, you know, it's telling people, like, listen, if you ever feel threatened in the slightest, you should shoot to kill, which is actually something a lot of police are basically trained to do because they're told that that's okay, and there's a lot of laws that protect the police that do that. But maybe that's not a good mentality to go into when you're dealing with someone who is going through a mental health issue, and they need, you know, understanding and support and not to be killed. So we're looking more closely at what we expect the police to do. And when you look at these sci-fi movies in the 50s and you see, you know, The Day the Earth Stood Still, and the military immediately show up to surround the flying saucer.
Mm.
And one guy just immediately goes, bang! And the alien goes, well, that was a gift for your president. And I forget what it was. It was
a communication device.
Yeah, it was going to help you communicate with the stars and learn everything about all cultures and gain a utopian society. But, well, I only brought one, so fuck it. That's on you, Private Reginald, or whatever the hell his name is. And it's just sort of just like, yeah, maybe that guy shouldn't have been at the front line of that.
Mm.
And we see that here, where the town is increasingly getting worked up into a mob.
Mm.
And here we have people who are, I mean, they're concerned.
Yeah.
The aliens are doing something strange, and they're not really explaining themselves very well for a long time, because people are going missing, or people seem to be controlled by an alien force. And when John Putnam finally is able to talk to an alien, the alien says, very simply, we're not here for you.
Mm.
We're not here to conquer the planet. We don't even care about your planet. This was like, This is like getting a flat tire in a small town on Route 66. We weren't going here.
Yeah.
We were passing by and we had to stop and we have to fix our ship. And unfortunately, we can't just walk around the way we are because we'd scare the shit out of you. So we've had to use some weird measures in order to infiltrate your society, get some supplies. We'll be out of here tonight if you can just keep your shit together and we won't bother you again. But of course, humanity won't let that happen because we're paranoid as hell.
Yeah, yeah. And this was the time for it, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Paranoia. Body snatcher stuff. A lot of fear. Body snatchers is real most commonly seen as an allegory about American fears of communism, about how this post-war idyllic 1950s perfectness that was being sold in media is going to be interrupted by interlopers, and not interlopers who look different from us, but just the idea of communism, and that's the thing that's going to mutate the populace.
It's so weird. We think that if you come into contact with this pamphlet, you'll be tainted forever, and you'll spread the disease of communism to everyone you meet.
Yeah.
And it's like, no, we don't have Twitter yet. We don't. We don't have Reddit. Like,
4chan isn't a thing yet.
That's a joke, but you know, it's absurd, basically. But it's America. You're legally allowed to be a communist if you want. You're allowed to think that would be a good idea.
But that sort of paranoia, this fear of the other, was a big running theme throughout a lot of genre films, a lot of films in general of the 1950s.
There was a lot of panic. There was a lot of fear. It was the Cold War, so we're constantly worried about, whether or not we're going to get bombed into oblivion or bombed someone else to oblivion, or everyone gets bombed into oblivion. These ongoing talks of nuclear fallout are leading to all of these stories about mutants and giant ants and shit. Yeah, and
fear of nuclear radiation was a big part of this as well.
Yeah, we're starting to see a lot of horror revolving around scientific progress, fears of scientific progress, and our increasing xenophobia as America becomes more of a global superpower. And that's the movie. It's all right here. but this movie, like a lot of movies, kind of get a little waffly with it. It's like, okay, yeah, so this is a metaphor for why, paranoia is bad, and, we're getting, too worked up about all this nuclear proliferation. But also, isn't it exciting when we literalize it? We're going to do this over and over again until this becomes your reality. And it's like, that's irresponsible, I don't know.
You can tell which film, what side the films come down on, though, depending on who the main character is. And as with The Day the Earth Stood Still, the main character is the one who's the most scientifically curious. He's the one who's the most open-minded. He's the least rash of the characters, and he is a man of inaction. He's a man of thought.
Yeah.
And these films are pushing this narrative that it's actually the thinkers and the open-minded people who have the right idea, and the violence mongers who are in the wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something I appreciate.
Yeah, and it's a tragedy even towards the end when the aliens feel the need to resort to violence because they just want to get out of here safely. They're trying to protect themselves too. There's actually a fight between our hero and an alien who has taken the form of his girlfriend. And he's got a gun and he will use it, and he feels guilty about it afterwards, to his credit. And then she's got this awesome laser beam that carves stuff into a wall.
It's a really cool effect.
Yeah.
Where they animate the laser beam, but they've come up with this effect where a strip of rock falls out as he ducks, and it looks like the laser beam is slicing into the rock.
It's actually really convincing. I gotta say this. This movie, I feel like by modern standards, this movie might be considered a little tame in that it's actually about, you're right, it's about thoughtfulness, it's about avoiding conflict rather than throwing yourselves into it. The visual effects are good. Kind of just across the board. There's some really interesting really interesting cinematography, the way that they keep a lot of the aliens in shadow even when it's bright daylight. It's really creepy. There's this great bit where Barbara Rush is driving down the highway, and it looks like she's about to hit one of these guys that we know has already been taken over by an alien or replaced by an alien. And it's clearly a rear screen projection.
Yeah.
Because we're not actually going to run that guy over. But I don't know if it was intentional or not. I wouldn't be surprised if it was. As she gets close to him, the perspective warps and he looks way too tall. Like, not a lot. He's like, he goes, he's clearly like 6 feet, but he looks like 8. Huh. And it's a little subtle thing, but it's really unnerving. And it just reminds you of just how, again, alien these people are, and how, like, the rules don't seem to apply to them. And, like, when they reach out and grab someone, they just become covered in mist, and you don't know what that is. Are they mist? Are they breathing out mist?
Yeah,
and, it's not really explained, because we don't have the tools necessary to even understand them.
And they're also body snatchers. Well, they're not body snatchers.
They're snatching people's bodies, but they're fine.
Well, they're shapeshifters. They, like, take people away and then take their place.
Yeah, there's this great bit where...
And that's where the paranoia comes in. The people you know are being replaced.
There's this great bit where Richard Carlson, towards the end, meets... one of the aliens has taken his form and is acting opposite himself via editing and a little bit of split screen, not a lot. And I actually gotta tell you, I've never been, like, super impressed by Richard Carlson as an actor. I think he's fine. Like, I got no harsh words against him. But I actually think he's really good in this movie. Like, I think he's, like, I think just that one bit where he got to play opposite himself and he got to have all of this weird authority of, like, the cosmos and sell it. And while being opposite himself, being this kind of meek and callow and just this nerdy type. I was like... Dude has some range, actually. Like, I owe him a little bit of an apology. I think he's a better actor than I ever gave him credit for. I really like him in this film. I think he's one of those actors who most people don't know, but if you watch enough sci-fi films in the 50s, you're going to run into him. I also think Barbara Rush is great in this movie.
Barbara Rush is really good. I think this was one of her first roles.
She got a Golden Globe for this, for, like, upcoming like star.
Newcomer or some such thing.
Yeah. Golden Globes don't mean anything, but still cool. She is that good. She is that good, though.
She got somebody's attention.
Yeah, she's good.
We also have, not Russell Watson.
Johnson.
Russell Johnson. Russell Watson sang the Enterprise theme song. Russell Johnson, who probably most famous for Gilligan's Island. He played the professor, but he's also in a lot of science fiction films from this era. He was also in This Island Earth.
Which we just mentioned, yeah. So yeah, he plays like one of the townsfolk. He's like the first one to get taken over or replaced by an alien. He's good. Yeah. Everyone's good in this. It's well produced.
Yeah, and the aliens are nice and eerie. When they get taken over, people's voices change. They stand stock upright, and they don't really behave like regular human beings.
Yeah.
But it's not in that Body Snatchers Insidious sort of way. Like,
they're all monotone and creepy.
Where they're like trying to lie to you. It's like, hey, I thought you didn't like meat. Yes, I don't like meat. Why are you eating the houseplants? Oh, is that yes, that is an unusual thing, isn't it? Like, they're not trying to pull one over on you.
Yeah.
Like, they're just stocks, they're off, and they affect the voice a little bit.
They're just trying to go by unnoticed. They're not trying to infiltrate society. Mm. They're not trying to take over society. They just need to get around a bit to get the materials they need to fix their spaceship.
Yeah.
And they're just trying to do that as off the radar as they can. And whenever they interact with somebody, they know their cover's going to get blown.
Yeah.
Because they're deep in, for all they know, enemy territory.
Mm.
And they don't know enough about the society to convincingly infiltrate or even talk convincingly like a human, because there's all these subtle cadences and intonations, and we know something is wrong because we know George. George doesn't talk like that. That's weird that George is talking like that. That kind of thing. Ultimately, I feel like It Came From Outer Space, it really does stand out amongst very similar material. And there's Invasion of the Body Snatchers, Invaders from Mars, and It Came from Outer Space. Really do seem like the three 1950s sci-fi templates of this, of the aliens coming down to Earth, taking over a small town. And they all have different perspectives. Body Snatchers, you're right, it's a Cold War allegory or fears of communism and other forms of American paranoia. Yeah, it's all about an older man, someone who's middle aged, and he's just seeing the world taken over, and nobody believes him. Everyone thinks he's a kook. Invaders from Mars is about a small child, and no one believes him because he's a small child, and it feels like a nightmare.
Yeah,
because when you're a child, you already feel powerless, because in many respects you are. Society isn't built for you. So when he tells everybody, "No, my parents have been taken over by aliens," they're like, "They're their sport," and it's annoying and condescending as fuck. By the way, the ending of that movie is legendary. Don't ruin it. Just see it. It's that good. And then this one is, I think the reason why it kind of feels like it lands in the middle of those is because those are two nightmare scenarios. This is a thoughtful scenario in which all of the violence, all of the horror, all of that is considered quite a tragedy.
Yeah.
And this really should have been very simple. And that's where I feel like the Ray Bradbury influence obviously comes in. Apparently Ray Bradbury wrote two treatments for this. One where the aliens were villainous and one where the aliens were this, neutral.
Mm.
And the studio went for the neutral take, and that's why Ray Bradbury was like, good. that was a test. You passed. But I like this one a lot. And regarding how it connects to the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Yeah, I was just going to attempt to do this.
And here's what I was thinking about. I don't think it's that direct. Obviously, aliens have come to Earth and they're impersonating us, and that's in Rocky Horror Picture Show. But when you think about Rocky Horror as a story about outsiders,
yeah,
you know, that's the thing. Like, there's a reason why Frankenfurter and Riff Raff and all of these
Transylvanians,
why they're not living in Denton, USA.
Mm.
They're living here. Denton would not accept them. And whatever, like, laser weapons they have or whatever like that, they would probably... Dentonites would be the villains if Frankenfurter ever just showed up and said, "Hello, I have moved into your town." And you realize all of a sudden that, you know, on some level, that although they are so confident and powerful, they are outsiders still.
Mm-hmm.
And they only occupy this one small part of this community.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them are just trying to get home.
Yeah.
And it actually made me think about those characters, because we've been talking a lot about how Frankenfurter, even though their confidence is so infectious and their sexuality is so empowering, that even though they're a villain, you kind of admire them, but you can't deny that they're a villain. Thinking about it in context with It Came From Outer Space actually made me think of all of those characters way more sympathetically.
Because
maybe we just don't understand them.
I would... The take with the Rocky Horror Picture Show was, imagine if instead of being Brad and Janet, these sort of innocents who are unfamiliar with all the sexuality that they're bringing in, imagine you had a scientist character.
Uh-huh.
Not a Dr. Scott. Like
Kinsey.
Yeah, Kinsey showed up and he's like, yes, let me document all of these weird sexual things. And eventually he's like, this is a very interesting way to live. And then, but word is leaked out to some anti-sex military force.
Yeah.
And they're going to roll up tanks.
Turns out Ralph Hapshad was actually involved, like the sheriff in town, and he's going to like bring everyone in to kill.
Who's the Seduction of the Innocent guy?
Vern or something? Hold on. Seduction of the Innocent.
Yeah, the book Seduction of the Innocent is this rather notorious tome, which was coming
Frederick
down.
Frederick Wortham,
that asshole. Yeah,
just sounds like a villain in a Dickens book. Yeah.
Dr. Wortham wrote this book that he was concerned that popular media at the time, and at the time this was like the early 50s.
Yeah, and specifically comics.
Specifically comics, but media in general was selling bad values to kids.
Yeah.
And this was a time of, you know, Tales from the Crypt, ultra-violent comics. So...
a lot of them. But there was also superhero stuff.
He was also writing things like, oh no, kids can't see Batman and Robin because clearly they're gay and that'll make them gay. So censor those comics. And
it was
all just this extreme right-wing censorship campaign.
It led to an uproar. Literally, comics were burned in the streets. Mm. And it led to the creation of the Comics Code Authority, which was a system of self-censorship that comics dealt with for decades, much like Hollywood had the production code.
And it's kind of
drifted
away
by now. No, it's
gone
now. It was always voluntary. In the 90s, he started seeing... It was still mainstream comics.
They started putting there was a little seal on the cover of comics, and it was getting smaller and smaller and smaller.
And eventually, just they stopped bothering.
Yeah.
And there was an understanding that if it was for mature readers, it would say for mature readers.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it was considered basically for everyone.
Yeah, but Seduction of the... Imagine that guy was like the bad guy in a Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Yeah.
He's going to come in and he's going to shut down the castle and turn down all these orgies.
Yeah, it's a different take on the basic premise. I think Rocky Horror is more complicated than that, but makes you think.
Look up the Wortham Trials at some point.
Because
William Gaines, the publisher of Tales from the Crypt and Mad Magazine, was in courts, like, saying the most frustrating things. It's like they'd hold up Tales from the Crypt. Is this an appropriate cover? It's a horror comic. It's supposed to scare you. It's totally appropriate. No!
Well, do you think children should be reading this? It's not for children. Ah!
A five-year-old gets a hell of this? That's an irresponsible parent. No!
But
your kids read this? Yeah, if they're 15 or so, it's
again,
for them.
The majority of the superheroes that we're talking about today that are, like, taking over popular culture... They were created in the wake of Seduction of the Innocent, because the Comics Code Authority all of a sudden meant that a lot of the comics that people were making couldn't be made anymore. The horror, the sci-fi, they all had to like kind of go away. And now they had to work within, basically they had to make stories for children for the most part.
Yeah.
And so Stan Lee, who was getting really frustrated with everything he was writing for Marvel, was like, okay, I want to make superheroes that are kind of interesting to me. And he actually said that like when he did like the Fantastic Four or whatever, I think it was the Fantastic Four was the one he did. Because I'm going to take a superhero comic and they're going to be nerds. And everyone's going to know who they are. They're not going to wear masks and they're going to complain. And one of them is going to be a cigar-chomping Brooklynite instead of like a trendy young cool kid. And he was just like, and if I get fired, he was basically trying to get fired. If I get fired, so be it. And it was so different. It sold like hotcakes.
Yeah.
And so they started doing interest. Basically, because there was nothing else they could do, there were no other genres that were safe for them because they could only speak in allegory. Superhero comics had to pick up more slack and get more interesting. That's kind of why we're here. And I often wonder if this asshole hadn't written this large, long since completely discredited work.
Yeah.
If comics in popular culture would have been completely different.
Yeah, for sure.
And they probably would have, at least now. Mm. You know, like now that comics have infiltrated everything. Like there was a time like 25 years ago where they hadn't. They had their corner and that was that. And yeah, it would have been a very different world. But we digress a little bit. But regardless, I think that's ultimately what we're talking about here. Is this is a movie about how we treat outsiders of any kind. Mm. And it's obviously it's a metaphor, but you can apply this metaphor to anything. And that's why I think it works on that universal horror level. Because regardless of whether they do monstrous things, the Frankenstein monster, Dracula, the mummy, they're sympathetic.
Yeah.
It's hard to understand necessarily why they kill. But we understand their motives for doing it. There's no place for them in this world. And they're trying to find love, companionship, something. Just, something to latch on to.
Just empathy. That's all they're really looking for.
Yeah, and the fact that they can't get it is what leads them to monstrous things. Because they have no other options most of the time. I mean, Dracula less so because he has to kill to live. But mostly.
The aliens in this are a little bit more technically minded. They actually know where they stand in terms of how humanity is going to treat them.
Yeah, they have no expectations otherwise. Yeah, they're not trying to reach out to us.
They're cynical, and rightly so, about humanity. Mm-hmm. Because they know humanity is going to hurt them. So it's not about them looking for empathy. But when they encounter it, they're not sure what to do with it.
Yeah.
And they actually, the empathetic character is the one who ends up orchestrating peace and their escape and the fact that everybody lives. It doesn't turn into a bloodbath.
This would be a great double feature with Contact. Yeah, it's kind of the exact opposite. Like, all the aliens are like, hey, it's worth reaching out to them. And here the aliens like, it's not yet. No. There's a reason we don't do this.
We're not ready.
Yeah. Even like the whole like ending of Contact where it's just like, well, we can't show you what we really look like. Mm. It actually makes more sense here. Because if they'd actually just say, because we're like weird squid leviathans and your brain couldn't handle it. Mm. If they'd actually just said that, I would have been like, thank you. It kind of feels like a cheat when we're just your dad. Like,
why do you look like my dad? Look, I'm an 800-foot squid leviathan. You know, you don't know how to talk to something like that.
It'd be great if there was that scene in Beetlejuice where he's just like, can I be scary? What do you think of this? And just cuts to behind him and the, like, beetle legs. Yeah. Like,
whatever those things
out of his
are.
Face and they all look in terror. Like, if there'd been, like, one shot in Contact, like, are you my dad? It's like, no, I just look like your dad. And the reason I look like your dad is because normally I look like this. And you just see Jodie Foster's face going, ah! And I'm just like, you see why I'm your dad? Yeah. And she's like, uh-huh.
And she's got
you need
blood,
a hug, sweetheart?
Blood coming out of her eye. It's like, hang on, I need a minute.
Yeah. But no, I really dug this one. I hadn't seen this, and I really dug it, and it's way more thoughtful than I thought it would be. And once I saw that Jack Arnold directed it, I'm like, oh, I might be in good hands. And it turns out, he's a really good director.
I got to see this back in college. I saw it as a double feature with Black Lagoon.
Oh, and that's cool.
Yeah, and both of them in that Anaglyph 3D, so that was really great.
That's awesome. I've never seen a black and white film in 3D.
Oh, yeah?
I don't think so. No, I've never seen a black and white film in 3D.
You've seen in Anaglyph, though, the red and blue.
I've seen 3D in various forms. I've never had an opportunity to see one of the early black and white movies that were released in 3D.
Some repertory theaters around town, including the one I used to work for, the New Art, would very occasionally have 3D festivals. Mm. And it's occasional because they need to replace the screen.
Mm.
There's a reason we called it the silver screen. It used to be silver. It used to be more reflective.
Yeah.
And that Anaglyph red and blue 3D doesn't pop as well on a white screen, so they replaced it with a silver screen.
So that's why Spy Kids 3D sucked.
Well, that's why.
That's the only reason.
That's why the 3D might have sucked.
I find that movie kind of charming, actually. actually. It's not great. It's not the best of the series, but it's kind of
cute. It was Ricardo Montalban's last movie.
Was it really?
Yeah.
That's too bad. It's too bad that he's gone. He's fine in the movie. I like how Rodriguez treated him. As royalty, as he should be.
Because he's
like, it's Ricardo, cool that we got Ricardo Montalban. Yeah.
And in the movie, he was very old at the time, and he was in a wheelchair, so the character's also in a wheelchair.
Flies at one point.
Well, his mind is projected into a video game, so they like CGI his head onto like a robot body and ends up like chasing a butterfly because he can finally do that again.
That was cute. Yeah. That was cute. Right,
and Ricardo Montalban was 100% on board. Yeah. Like, oh yes, I like that.
Yeah,
I got the robot body.
Anyway, that's it for episode 0 this week. Thank you everybody for listening. We hope you enjoyed our trip through It Came from Outer Space. Next week, we are giving sci-fi a miss. We've done a lot of sci-fi and horror. And although it's called the Rocky Horror Picture Show, that's not all it was about. And we're actually going to look at an early 19... I don't have that year in front of me. A 1940s Alfred Hitchcock classic. It was Alfred Hitchcock's first film in color, and it is a very ambitious film with a lot of themes that Hollywood was...
with a lot of themes.
Well, I was... There was a pause. I was going to finish that sentence.
It's about things.
It's
we live in a society.
We're going to talk a lot about queer coding.
Yeah.
In the next episode, because we're going to be talking about Alfred Hitchcock's classic film, Rope. Which is a real stunner. There was a time when this was actually really unavailable. Like, there were like 5 of Hitchcock's best movies that were just not available. And then they got finally released in like the 80s. And everyone's like, holy shit, Rope is good. And
These two young men who are rather clearly lovers, although it's not explicitly stated.
Gresham Code.
As an intellectual thrill, just for the intellectual thrill, commit a murder. And just to put a cherry on it, hide the body in their apartment and have a party immediately thereafter.
Yeah.
And while the body's still in the apartment.
And you're constantly waiting to see if they're going to get found out, if someone's going to look in that box or whatever. It's incredible. It's thrilling. It's going to be a real interesting conversation. It's one of my favorite Hitchcock films, and that's saying something. So that'll be next week on episode 0. Thank you, everybody, for listening. You can, if you want to write in, talk about anything we discussed on this episode or anything at all, really, our email podcast is We've Got Mail. You can email us letters@criticallyacclaimed.net and we might read your email in an upcoming episode. But we're also on Twitter @CriticAcclaim. I'm @WilliamBibiani.
I'm @WhitneySeibold.
We have a Patreon, patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. And we are especially grateful to all of our Patreon listeners. All of our subscribers are the reason why this show and all of our other shows exist. And without them, they wouldn't. It's just that simple. So to everyone who can afford to subscribe now or in the future, even in the past, we know times are hard and not everyone can do so consistently. We're incredibly grateful to you. If you do want to sign up, if you haven't already, you can vote for future episodes of our podcast. You get a ton of exclusive podcasts about Batman, Star Trek, the Academy Awards, Disney. You get commentary tracks. It's a lot. Of course, we also have a soap business. or rather, my wife and partner, M. Lopez da Silva, has a soap business, and I help out. It's called Salt Cat Soap, and it is currently on Etsy. These are handcrafted, individually designed. 99% of them will be designed by Michelle, but I will design a few over the course of the year to tie into, you know, geeky things or the Schmodown once in a while, but... Mostly they're amazing. Etsy.com. And if you search for Salt Cat Soap, you'll notice that Luca is a wonderful drawing of Luca is the logo. So that's available too. And thank you everybody who's already purchased some soap. We hope you enjoy it. We've already heard back from some people who do. And am I forgetting anything?
No, I think that's it.
Cool. All right. Well, until then, I see you shiver with Antis. Yeah.